This is Michael Gineau with Insight to Israel, coming to you from America's Web Radio, and I want to thank the guys at America's Web Radio for allowing the grassroots of the United States of America, the Patriot Conservatives, to know the truth about the greatness of the Jewish state and its struggle for sovereignty and security. It's a blessing to humanity. Thank you guys at America's Web Radio. I love you guys and appreciate the time. I want to share just real quick. Thank you to everyone who gave to Hershey's for Heroes. It has been a huge success. It is an ongoing project, and we have seen over 500 chocolate bars come from Americans all across the United States. And if you would like more information about how to contribute to Hershey's for Heroes, where Americans are sending chocolate bars with a note on them to the Israeli soldiers and with their name and the state that they're from, you can send me an email at Michael A. Gineau, G-A-N-O-E, at gmail.com. That's Michael A. Gineau, G-A-N-O-E. At gmail.com, or you can go to my Facebook page at Michael Gineau, G-A-N-O-E. So, anyway, thank you for that. I spent this week with the Special Forces soldiers of Golani, and they were amazed, and they were grateful. And so I'm working on some video that's going to come up to show you that their gratitude. So, anyway, today I have a very, I'm going to call him friend. I have a very special friend, a man that I have not known for that long, by the name of Richard Heidemann from Washington, D.C. And I will tell you that since I have known Richard, I have always felt at home with him and his wife, with his daughter Ariana, who lives in Washington, and his daughter Ilana, who lives here in, is it Efrat, Richard?
Nesharim.
Say it again.
Nesharim.
Nesharim, which is in Judea.
Mm-hmm. Near Hadassah Hospital.
Near Hadassah Hospital. And Ilana runs the Israel Forever Foundation.
She does. The Israel Forever Foundation is a U.S. a nonprofit 501c3 foundation that, among other things, is dedicated to sharing with the world the rich contribution of Israel and the Jewish people to culture and the arts and sciences and democracy, independence and freedom, and to building a better day through dignity for all people.
Wow, that's great. And I really do appreciate what the Israel Forever Foundation does, especially in the area which is my heart, the Lone Soldiers.
Yes, there is the Lone Soldier Project of the Israel Forever Foundation. Recently, in coordination with the people from the Embassy of Israel in Washington, there was an event there. There's other events going on for purposes of providing support and help and aid and comfort to the lone soldiers who come from all over the world. To stand up and be counted, and then at the end of their term, they head back to their home countries, or they adopt Israel as their new home country.
They make Aliyah.
Many of them do.
You know, for all the listeners out there, as you take in all of the programs that we do, you can go to the website, Insight to Israel, America's Web Radio. I want to challenge you to educate yourself. Don't just take other people's word for it. Don't hear the word lone soldier and then just wonder what it is. Go and research it. A lone soldier is someone who, a young person, male or female, that has no obligation to this military, to this country, and they come here and they serve willingly. And they are a fascinating, fascinating group of young people. And I'll tell you, when it comes to Islam and the leftist media, it is a with the Israeli-born Jews that are, it's mandatory for them to serve in the military. They know when an Ima looks at her child, she knows that that child must defend the Jewish state. And so they're constantly inundated with all this negativity. But when they see a lone soldier come from another country with no obligation, what a morale booster. It's amazing what a morale booster it is to this military. And I'm glad for them. So, and I've got to spend a lot of time with them. So, you know, go to the Israel Forever Foundation website, and you will find the Lone Soldier Project there. And I want to encourage you, go to that website. Don't just go to it, but give to it. And so, anyway, Richard, I want to say thank you for being here. I see you as, even though we don't talk all the time, we don't interact, just our conversation here this morning before we started recording, I want to say thank you for your instruction as an elder, as a seasoned man. Thank you for your instruction that you give me.
Thank you, ma'am.
And thank you for being here and talking to us today.
Well, Michael, thank you for inviting me. I'm here in Israel, as you know, because I'm privileged to serve as the honorary chairman of the Student Conference on International Law, which is sponsored by the outstanding organization Stand With Us. It's a great advocacy organization that talks straight and teaches excellent lessons. Stand With Us brought here to Jerusalem 40 students from 17 different countries, 23 or 24 different languages, to get exposed to international legal issues, to get exposed to thinkers, to get exposed to the reality of life challenges and opportunities here in Israel. The students, I believe, are exhilarated over the experience that they've had. And so I had the opportunity to deliver a lecture to the students earlier this week. The topic that I focused in on was what I like to refer to as standing up against terrorism. We have in the United States, there used to be 7 countries on the U.S. Department of State list of state sponsors of terror. Now there are 4. Syria and Iran head the list of the remaining countries that are on the State Department list of state sponsors of terror. Syria has been a state sponsor of terror since 1979. Iran has been on the list since, I believe, 1984. And the world does nothing to stop Syria and stop Iran's sponsorship of terror. They not only tolerate it, but by not standing up against it, they actually encourage it.
Right.
And between the Islamic Republic of Iran and the Syrian Arab Republic, weapons and munitions and money and Iranian Revolutionary Guard move from Iran across Syria for training camps, for other activities, into safe houses, and then, of course, down into the hands of Hezbollah in Lebanon. Hezbollah is a terrorist organization listed by the U.S. Department of State as a foreign terrorist organization. The European Union recently classified the military wing of Hezbollah as a terrorist organization, but refused to brand Hezbollah itself as a terrorist organization, somehow creating this fictional divide between a terrorist organization attacking people and killing them and a terrorist organization providing aid. I don't know how you can possibly make such a fictional divide. But so we addressed during the Stand With Us program, at least in the lecture that I delivered, we addressed the issue of using the example of Libya, which was on the State Department list of state sponsors of terror, and Syria and Iran and the judgments that have been entered in U.S. federal courts on behalf of victims of Iranian terrorism, victims of Syrian terrorism.
Wow.
And I also explained in my lecture about the case study example, shall we say, of Libya, because Libya was on the State Department list. President George W. Bush, working with then Prime Minister Tony Blair, worked with the Gaddafi regime to bring Libya back over the line. They turned over weapons of mass destruction. They agreed to no longer sponsor terror. They agreed to compensate American victims of Libyan terrorism. Gaddafi actually paid $1.5 billion to a fund for purposes of compensating American victims of Libyan terror. And then he essentially got a get-out-of-jail-free card. But I'd like to talk about that a little more in a moment. Back to you, Michael.
No, listen, it's, well, first of all, I want to say this. Listening to you share some facts with us, and speaking about the European Union, you know, it amazes me, Richard, that, look, I'm just a lay person here, you know? I can't say I have a degree in education, and I don't think I've ever used it. But, you know, it's amazing sometimes that all of the elites, the educated, and I have nothing against education, so I don't want to be misunderstood, but it sometimes seems as though the more higher up you get in education, unless you've kept your feet on the ground, the more self-centered you become in your views. And I think that's a fine example of the EU when it comes to Hezbollah. It's all the PhDs, and they break things down. And you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but it just, there's a lot of self-centeredness that goes on in the EU, and I'll tell you why. What my version of it is because they have left the principles, I believe. And I don't want to veer off, but when you become self-centered and not having an understanding that there is a creator, someone bigger than you out there, you know, you tend to lose that, and you focus on things that are not so important. And that's why I think that how we get into the rat's nest of trying to dichotomize between this side of Hezbollah and that side when it's all bad. And so, to come back to what you were saying, what, at the end of the day, what has led you to do all this? Why? Because you're a man, you're successful, you live in Washington, D.C. You could probably sit back and enjoy your life, and hearing you speak, you have all this knowledge. Why do you put so much effort into it?
Michael, I believe that people have an obligation to stand up for other people, to protect other people, to recognize and respect the dignity of man, no matter their race, creed, color, religion, no matter their orientations, no matter their life's choices. We're all humans, and we have an obligation to care for one another. Caring includes protecting, and caring includes speaking out on behalf of people who have no voice, or speaking out on behalf of people who aren't able to speak for themselves. So, as you know, I had the privilege of serving two elected terms as the president of B'nai B'rith International, the oldest and largest Jewish service and advocacy organization in the world. When I finished my term, my second term in office, I was asked by people, so what are you going to do next? And I said, we're going to take on Muammar Gaddafi. And they laughed.
And I'm not laughing because that's a big undertaking.
They laughed. And the fact of the matter is, working with other law firms and lawyers, working with in a convergence of efforts with members of Congress, the House and the Senate, with victims, with other lawyers who represent other victims.
Wow.
We're working with the White House, working with the State Department. 5 years later, President Bush signed an executive order that gave Libya back, shall we say, its state immunity in the United States, immunity from prosecution for past acts.
Yeah.
It accepted an agreement with Gaddafi that, as I say, Gaddafi turned over weapons of mass destruction, agreed not to pursue nuclear weapons, agreed to provide information and support to the United States.
Wow.
Gaddafi agreed, and I'm not praising him for his past acts.
Absolutely.
I'm simply reporting on what occurred just in 2008. That's only 5 years ago. It's included his payment of this $1.5 billion for American victims of Libyan terrorism.
Like Lockerbie.
People who died in the Pan Am 103 bombing.
Yeah.
Our clients who were victims of the Egypt Air Flight 648 hijacking, the Rome and Vienna airport attacks.
Now, is this the one you recently... What was the one you recently... I don't mean to interrupt you. What was the recent one that I read about a few months ago?
Yes, we sued in U.S. federal court both Libya and Syria as state sponsors.
Okay, Syria, okay.
With Libya, a settlement was reached through the State Department, and some of the victims have received monies as a result of that. But it didn't preclude us from continuing in federal court against Syria as a state sponsor of terror.
That's one of the world's largest.
Indeed. Syria has been on the State Department list since 1979. It sponsored and hosted the Abu Nidal terrorist organization in terrorist training camps in Syria and in the Syrian-controlled Baqa Valley on the border with Lebanon, provided safe houses, and U.S. federal judges have determined Syria to be a state sponsor of terror, determined that Syria hosted Abu Nidal, determined that Syria provided material support for these terrorist activities. Some of the Abu Nidal terrorists took off and went to Rome, and others went to Vienna, and others went to Athens, and in Athens they hijacked an airplane. They put the Americans and the Israelis into first class.
Wow.
When the plane landed in Malta, they were letting people off the airplane one country at a time because they had collected all the passports. And the Abu Nidal terrorists, when the first Israeli woman was called forward, she reached out for her passport, and they blew her brains out. And then they shot the next Israeli woman. One died, one survived. I've interviewed the Israeli woman who survived.
Wow.
Three Americans took bullets in the brain. One died and two survived. The two who survived testified in U.S. federal court in Washington, D.C. regarding this case. And it was just a horror-filled experience to hear them relive the terrorism that they, as Americans, and their religion is irrelevant.
Right.
But the fact is, none of the Americans were of the Jewish faith. This was a targeted attack on Israelis and Americans in 1985. 1 month later, the Abu Nidal terrorists shot and killed people at the TWA and the LL ticket counters. That's LL, Israel Airlines.
Yeah.
TWA ticket counters.
Wow.
Killing and maiming Americans, Israelis, and other tourists who were simply traveling on TWA airplanes. I've interviewed the surviving Abu Nidal terrorists. They were trained, supported by Libya, supported by Syria, trained, and U.S. federal courts in each of those cases have now found Syria to be liable and awarded sizable judgments that we're in the process of working on collecting.
I read about that. How do you collect that much money from a country that's in chaos? How do you do that? Like, I can go after their accounts, I'm sure, their overseas accounts, but that's a huge... I can't even comprehend that with my mind.
Well, U.S. law permits that once you have a judgment against a foreign state that's on the State Department list of state sponsors of terror, you can apply to a federal court for permission to begin attaching their assets. You can follow procedures to obtain sealed information from the U.S. Department of Treasury about assets of those countries,
like houses,
frozen,
cars
that may be frozen in the United States.
Yeah.
And then you can pursue attachment proceedings like in a normal collection case.
Nice.
Outside the United States, you have to find a foreign country that's willing to recognize and domesticate a U.S. foreign judgment, and then allow attachment, and some countries will and some countries won't.
Right.
It's a very difficult and expensive and time-consuming process, but it's all part of standing up against terrorism. You know, the military, the intelligence people, it's their jobs to stand up against terrorism, and I believe that we, as fellow citizens, have an obligation
Absolutely.
To stand up for victims of terror, to not just speak out, but to do things on behalf of those victims to bring them justice. And I'd actually like to draw a connection, if I may, back to the Libya Syria issue, because I commented earlier, Michael, that in 2008 Gaddafi was given a get out of jail free card.
Right.
Within just a few years, he turned on his own people, and the United States didn't stand for it. France didn't stand for it. UK didn't stand for it. Other countries didn't stand for it. And it didn't take long before Gaddafi was removed. Gaddafi was dead. Saif al-Islam Gaddafi, his son, was charged before the International Criminal Court with crimes against humanity and war crimes violations. Libya today is emerging as a stronger country, a more democratic, shall we say, country, with respect for the rule of law and human rights. And Gaddafi himself, Muammar Gaddafi, is dead. Removed and dead. His son is, as I say, in prison. And my question is this, Michael. How is it that the world focused in on Gaddafi, who did come back over the line, reached that agreement with President Bush and Prime Minister Blair, had a free day, turned on his people, was held accountable, but Bashar Assad in Syria has now reportedly killed 100,000 Syrians, more than 1 million refugees of the Syrian Arab Republic,
right.
Recently gassing his own people. They say that some of the evidence still isn't clear, but Secretary Kerry has made it clear that the evidence is clear.
Right.
And my question is, where is the outcry in the world to stand up against Bashar Assad and his regime and hold them responsible? And accountable to the International Criminal Court for war crimes violations and for crimes against humanity. And I believe all of us listening here today, all of us need to band together and talk about, speak out about, speak up for the people of the Syrian Arab Republic to help build a new day for them, one that's based upon human rights and dignity, and that holds the Bashar Assad regime fully accountable for these atrocities.
Now, I agree with you, Richard, but I will tell you, this is what I'm hearing on the ground from the grassroots. And I talk to a lot of Israelis on a daily basis, and I talk to a lot of the military, and what they're telling me is, look, you've got two factions in Islam, Sunni and Shia. Sunni and Shia kill for power. And at the end of the day, both of them call for the destruction of Israel. Now, what I'm hearing on the ground here, and what I'm hearing from a lot of Americans is, here they say, you know what? No matter who wins that war, we're going to have to deal with them in the end. Because at the end of the day, they're Islamic. what I'm hearing from people in the U.S. at the grassroots level is they don't want to get involved. And look, compassion, I have a lot of compassion. A lot of Americans don't want to get involved because you got guys like John McCain that are going over there and saying these are freedom fighters. And our CIA is training them. We're giving them funding and arms. And those arms have been proven, those quote-unquote freedom fighters, which I don't call them as such, are turning and shooting at Israeli soldiers here in Israel on the border. So, and they're eating the hearts. I'm sure you saw the video of the one commander for the quote-unquote freedom fighters that's eating the heart of an Israeli soldier. How do we, you know, legitimately deal with that? You know, we want to have compassion on the people, but how do we deal with such situations like that when, you know, when we see these things take place? How do you deal with that? How do you wrestle with that?
Well, you have connected in your question, Michael, the rights of the people of the Syrian Arab Republic with Israel. And I don't believe that connection.
I don't want to interrupt you, but let me clarify that the Israeli government, the military, has helped a lot of the Syrian refugees.
Absolutely. I don't think we should draw that connection. What I have raised is not about the safety and security of Israel. Yes, I fully stand for the safety and security of Israel, of the Jewish people, and of all people who live here in the region. What I am saying is I'm talking about all people who live here in the region.
Right.
The Israelis, the Palestinians, the Egyptians, the Jordanians, the Lebanese, and the Syrians.
Right.
So I want to refocus for a moment on the Syrians.
Okay.
Under the terrorist regime of Assad, in the last 2 years, first a reported 10,000, then 30,000, then 50,000, 60,000, all confirmed by the United Nations. Now over 100,000 people have died. The world hasn't cared. The world hasn't done anything. Today the world isn't doing anything to protect those people.
Yeah.
People gassed, and everyone's talking.
Yeah.
Children and families, refugees, a million refugees, and the world is just barely talking. Russia and China standing up at the United Nations and not agreeing with President Obama to stand against Syria at the Security Council of the United Nations.
Yeah.
And now you even see just during this time period, disagreement in various countries whether or not anything should be done in relation to Syria to put a stop.
Yeah.
How can the world stand aside when you have the atrocity and the massacre of 100,000 people, people gassed, and a million refugees? It's unconscionable. We have to give voice to the Syrian people who are these victims.
Absolutely.
And that is my point.
No, I agree with you. It's a tough thing. I would not want to be in anybody's shoes to make that kind of huge decision, because you do have Iran, China, and Russia that have worked together to help Iran. And so it's a tough thing. The United States is in a tough spot, and you're right. We have to do something. It's a matter of, it's a matter of deciding which direction to go. We got a lot of noise in the background, but that's okay. It adds all the odds to the radio show. Listen, Richard, we're going to come back and talk about your book, because and what led up to that. Because a lot of the stuff that you've done on behalf of the victims of terror, it's amazing the work that you put in. I can't imagine the man hours. But we're going to come back and we're going to talk about that book. And I want to say again, thank you for being here. And this is Michael Gannot with Insight to Israel. We'll be right back.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
And we're back. with Insight to Israel. And what a great first half. You know, and I apologize, I'm used to saying my mother raised me to make reference to folks that are more seasoned than myself as Mr. or Mrs. or Miss. So I hope, Richard, it's not... I hope you don't seem as impolite, and I don't think you do. It just kind of plays on my conscience a little bit because I respect you, Mr. Heidemann. So I hope you don't mind if I call you Richard.
I don't mind. It's because of my gray hair, I get it.
Listen, you fed to me. That was like the information you gave me in the first half was like a buffet of truth. And while you took a break and were interviewing earlier in between segments, I was out on the balcony picking it out of my teeth with an ideological toothpick. So thank you for that information, and I hope that folks that are listening take what you said and do research into it. Go, and we're going to provide the website to your new book, The Hague Odyssey. I want folks to read it. I want them to read it, and I appreciate the copy that you're giving me. And so that's part of the reason why you're here in Israel, is because, look, even though not everybody's, we know not everyone here speaks Hebrew, a lot of the Americans that, thank God, have made Aliyah and moved here to the Jewish state bravely, and a lot of them live in Judea and Samaria. I respect them. I love them. I spend a lot of time up there. Zahava Englard, Mark Provisor, a lot of these folks. And so we know that this book is going to be good for them to read, to consume, not just to have on their coffee table as a decoration and something else to add to the library, but information that will arm them with truth and arm the American people with truth, with what we are up against, not just here in Israel, but as Americans, as we travel all over the country, there's a threat against us. So thank you for all the information. Thank you for taking the time to write the book. You know, I went to your press conference the other day, and sometimes in my mind, what I conceive as a picture doesn't always come out of my mouth the right way. But I had asked you a question because I pictured you and your law firm, the men that work with you, the great men that contributed.
Excuse me, Michael. Men and women.
Men and women. Thank you for clarifying that. No, you're absolutely correct. The men and women in your law firm in Washington, D.C., that contributed to these court battles that you went through in The Hague, and to bring this truth to light. I can't imagine the hours you put in.
Well, thank you, Michael. That's kind of you. If we all step back from our daily lives, if we return to our youth and the things and values we were taught by our family, by our friends during our youth, certain things stand out. And one of those things for me that stands out is my parents, may they rest in peace, encouraging me to always give honor to the dignity of my fellow man. They encouraged me to think about the other person, not just about myself. They encouraged me to advance my skills in order to be able to stand up for people, to speak out on their behalf, and to help achieve justice. There is, as you know, a very important watchword in a certain recent portion of the Torah. The Hebrew words are tzedek, tzedek, tirdof. Tzedek, tzedek, tirdof. Justice, justice, thou shalt pursue. And the concept of seeking justice for people for helping them be all they can be, for helping them do all they can do, and for giving them voice and opportunity to not just make their own commitment to a better day, but to achieving justice is something that I was taught as a young man and that I can continue to believe and that I try to share with others, because if more people would focus on bringing justice,
right,
we would also be focusing on preventing injustice.
Right. Right.
And it's in that context that I feel so strongly and have spoken so loudly here in Jerusalem this week, calling for action against Bashar Assad and the Syrian regime, because as I said earlier, Syria and the Syrian Arab Republic have been on the State Department list of state sponsors of terror since 1979. Mm. And is it any wonder that in a time of strife and a time of desperation, having committed and sponsored terrorist acts all over the world, not only directed toward Israel, but all over the world, is it any wonder that the Bashar Assad regime has turned on its own people?
Right.
A million refugees, children, 100,000 dead, now people gassed. It's just unconscionable. And so I repeat to everyone listening, please join me in a call for action and to hold the Syrian Arab Republic and the Bashar Assad regime accountable, not just in the court of public opinion, but in the International Criminal Court for war crimes and crimes against humanity, because what we are watching happen just up the road is unconscionable, unacceptable, unbelievable, and must be stopped. And if it's not going to be stopped by the Security Council at the United Nations, if it's not going to be stopped by individual countries, let it be stopped by the world standing together on behalf of the Syrian people, because perhaps the leaders of the world and the leaders of the countries that sit on the Security Council will hear the message and understand they must take action to put a stop to this carnage, to these acts of heinous murder going on in Syria.
Absolutely. You know, Richard, I always come back to this because I look at the lives of your daughters and what they do. Ilana, who I have a deep respect for her. And, you know, every time I see her, there's always... I just sense like she's like my sister, you know. I saw her husband one day in the Shuk, just at random, and it was like so good to see him. But I see what you've instilled in your children, those principles. And I say emphatically, always, without reservation, that not only do I owe my founding fathers for my freedom, they were men that even though that doctrinally they may have differed somewhat in Christianity, in religion, they didn't believe in a state-sponsored church, but they believed that God gives each man that individual privilege, that individual right to create his own destiny, to make his own way, to be successful in his life, to do the right thing, to live according to principle. But I owe it to the Jewish people, because if it had not been for Hashem giving them Torah, I would not have a constitutional Bill of Rights. And that's a fact. And so, you know, I'm thankful that even in your seasoned age, Richard Heidemann, that you, when you could say to yourself, I have every right to sit back, I've worked hard my whole life, my family's going through a great deal, your parents have been through a great deal of strife, now is my time to, after laboring, to sit back and watch the sunset and cast my eyes upon all of that which I've gained in life. But you continue to strive and work. And I'm thankful that, because you're an example to me. I'm 42 years old. When I came here, my brother, who's 35, three children, a car, two cars and a house, said, Michael, you need to be planning for your retirement. You need to think about the future. And yet, I can't. My conscience won't allow me to do that. when I see this country that strives, that gives mankind everything and strives for its existence. And I want to say thank you for your commitment in a day and age when we think that it's time, our time to relax and do, let someone else do it.
Well, Michael, you're very kind. Thank you for your words. But more important, in listening to your words, I'm inspired because the message you're sending to me sitting here and to all of those listening to us is a message of passionate commitment to justice and to helping to build a better world and a better day. I'm also most honored and appreciative of your words about our wonderful three daughters. Phyllis and I have three daughters, Stephanie and Ilana and Ariana. Each of them are great women, strong women, determined, bright, and passionate about their families and their friends and their future and the issues and subjects that are of concern to them. Both Stephanie and Ilana have strong, determined husbands who also work hard each day to help make the world around them better. And we have three grandsons that
are about to have another grandchild.
And we certainly pray for so.
Absolutely.
And pray for a healthy baby. So when it comes down to it, you know, people jokingly say, you can pick your friends, but you can't pick your family. I'm happy I can't pick my family because I'm just overjoyed and thrilled every day, Michael, with the family that we have. And
yeah.
I'm very, very proud of them. And I give tribute to my wife, Phyllis, who in her own work as a presidential appointee to the United States Holocaust Memorial
Museum
for five years.
Wow.
And in her work today as the chairman of the International Advisory Board of the March of the Living, which each year brings 10,000 young people and seniors and survivors from around the world to Auschwitz.
Yeah, I've seen it.
Birkenau and throughout Poland to understand not just to pay honor and respect to memory, but to understand the truthful history of how Jewish people and other minorities were treated in the Holocaust, who were murdered in the Shoah. They say that pictures are, of course, worth thousands of words. And anybody who doesn't take the time to go and personally visit the concentration camps, the gas chambers, the extermination camps, the killing centers, the oven, and see the ovens that were used to burn human beings. They are cheating themselves.
Yeah.
They're cheating the world because the evidence that is there of the Holocaust that has been preserved in the state museums, for example, in Poland, and must continue to be preserved, that evidence of hair that was cut off and shoes that were taken and canes and...
gold teeth. I mean, I don't know what's...
And all of the utensils they had, of this, so much of this has been stored and preserved and really has to be seen. This has to be seen on the ground because unless you can live through and learn from the experience and join the March of the Living when each day, each year on Holocaust Memorial Day, there is a march from Auschwitz to Birkenau, where people with survivors that are still able to make it, still alive, able to talk about it, walk hand in hand and arm in arm with Rabbi Lau, the former chief rabbi of Israel, and other key leaders, walk arm in arm on that death march and celebrate memory and celebrate life. That's really important work, and so I pay tribute to our three daughters, and I pay tribute to my wife for their passionate commitment to education and to making this world a better place. And in that context, you've asked me about the Hague Odyssey. Why did I write it?
Yeah.
And what is it about? I thank you for inviting people to look at thehagueodyssey.com. That's thehagueodyssey.com, thehagueodyssey.com. The Hague is a city in the Netherlands that is called The Hague, and it's where the International Court of Justice is based, and it's where the International Criminal Court is based, and it's at the International Court of Justice that in 2004 an advisory opinion was issued at the request of the UN General Assembly, and it was issued relating to legal questions regarding Israel's construction of the terrorism prevention security fence, which some prefer to refer to as a wall. Indeed, about 5 or 6% of the fence line is a concrete barrier.
I've been there. I've seen it. It's amazing.
And you know, when we drive on expressways in the United States, we all look at Jersey walls. And,
right.
And down at the Mexican border with the United States, there's a fence. And, of course, there's other walls all over the world, including the Great Wall of China that is a majestic, historic site and was built for defensive purposes. So, but the only fence or wall in the world that people call today to be torn down is Israel's terrorism prevention security fence, and it's referred to as a segregation wall, a separation barrier, an apartheid wall, in an attempt to malign Israel and accuse her of not respecting the dignity and rights of the Palestinian people. And it's not fair, it's not right, it's not factually right, and one recognizes that only as a result of the raging Second Intifada, when people were being killed in buses and restaurants and on pedestrian walks and in their homes and synagogues, only when one remembers the carnage going on here in Israel by terrorist bombers who blew themselves up or who used weapons to kill people, the world didn't care. The world didn't shout. The world didn't cry. The world didn't pay much attention. It was blamed on Israel rather than being blamed on those who sponsored the terrorists. So Israel resorted to doing a very essential thing, Michael, and that is to fencing out the terrorists, to building the terrorism prevention security fence, and to exercising the essential right of every government and the essential obligation of every government, and that is to protect and defend her people.
Absolutely.
And that's what the Hague Odyssey is all about.
You know, I'm glad that it runs along the same lines. I actually did a video called Jaunt Through Judea, where I went on a tour with a young lady that we spoke to, had on the show here. Yeah. And she took me through there, past the wall. I put it all on video. We actually got on the other side of the wall into the Judea area. And at that same time, Richard, the police, we showed the signs where, you know, there are Muslims, Arabs that have free reign all over this country. All the signs are in English, Arabic, and in Hebrew. And yet there are places that actually are Jewish land that Jews are forbidden to go on, because that's where the quote unquote Palestinians, Muslims, Arabs, however you want to terminalize it, that the Jews would be lynched if they went into. And at that same time, the military was being attacked. I was able to get it on video. It was being attacked, and with huge rocks and things thrown at them. And so they had to retaliate to defend themselves. And so this was a fine example that I was able to get on video to show to people. In fact, we talked about it. David Bedeen, who you're familiar with, even sent me an email and said, that was a very good video you did. So if you want to see Jean Through Judea, I'm working on Jean Through Judea 2. You can see exactly what Richard's talking about firsthand from a personal perspective. It's on YouTube. Just type in Michael Gano, Jean Through Judea. So, very needed book. It's amazing to see you come from this legal perspective, which I could never do. I don't have the experience or the background. So that's amazing that you put together this book.
Well, Michael, the Hague Odyssey is dedicated to the memory and the honor of the victims of terrorism. I call upon the world to really declare a war on terrorism. I'm not using a nomenclature that President Obama preferred to move from. President Bush referred to the war on terror. President Obama prefers not to refer to the war on terror. And I don't want to comment on that because this is not about political views.
Right.
I want to call upon the world to conduct a war against terrorism, to stand up for the dignity of every individual from every walk of life, every religion, wherever they may reside, wherever they may be, and understand they have the inherent human right to dignity and human right to protection from harm.
Right.
What Israel did with the construction of the Terrorism Prevention Security Fence is exercise its obligation and its right to defend her people.
Absolutely.
And Israel should be applauded for that, not maligned for that. Because, Michael, what happens at the United Nations is that Israel every year is called to task in resolution after resolution, some years upwards of 20 resolutions, more time and money spent on issues relating to maligning Israel than any other country in the world, notwithstanding what we see, for example, just on the northern border in Syria. No outcry, but yet when the UN General Assembly convenes next month, you can darn well be sure that Israel's going to be on the agenda, Israel will be maligned, and there will be no dignity accorded to the good name of the State of Israel. She will be accused of this and this and this. And quite candidly, with reluctance, I must comment on how disappointing and upsetting it was to hear the chairman of the Palestine Liberation Organization, who also serves as the president of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas, on the eve of the commencement of renegotiations, he or one of his people, whoever the spokesperson was, whoever this was attributed to, and I hope I'm not misquoting, so I'll just paraphrase, making a reference to the fact that there shall be no Israeli living in Palestinian territory. However that quote actually was made, the essential message was,
you nailed it,
no Jews allowed here. And when we look back in history, the concept of no Jews wanted here, no Jews allowed here,
right,
that in and of itself is racist. That in and of itself,
absolutely,
is discriminatory. That in and of itself, creating a Judenrein state, if that is the plan, if that is the goal, if that is the dream, it is unfair to say some people can't be here, because anywhere in Israel, anyone who's able to acquire an apartment or own a business or conduct their lives, they can do so without regard to what their religion is or what their race is or what their beliefs are.
They
have dignity here to do that. And in many other countries, but to hearken back to the concept of no blacks being allowed into
coffee shops
or get to the back of the bus or in washrooms and restrooms, and that's racism. In apartheid South Africa, that was racism,
right.
Real segregation. And to attempt to accuse Israel of being an apartheid racist state is in and of itself unconscionable, and everyone should resist it, reject it, stand against it, and not permit anyone from within the government or the administration of the Palestinian Authority or the Palestine Liberation Organization to even think about the concept that the future Palestinian state should be a Judenrein state free of Jews.
Yeah.
Because that in and of itself would be a racist, discriminatory state. And we can't have that, and we wouldn't tolerate it anywhere else in the world.
Right.
So why is Israel held to a double standard?
Absolutely. Let me also add to what you're saying that a lot of Americans don't know. When the Palestinian Authority in their schools teach their children, they show maps of Israel, but they don't acknowledge the Jewish state, and everything is quote-unquote Palestine. Everything that is Jewish-owned, Israeli-owned, let me clarify that, Israeli-owned, that includes the quote-unquote West Bank and the Gaza Strip, all of it is acknowledged to be theirs.
There is no question that there are some who have the absolute goal of driving the Jews back into the Mediterranean Sea.
Yeah.
And who say that Tel Aviv is not to be part of Israel, and who do not give the right to Israel to stand as a sovereign nation. But the fact is, the state of Israel is a sovereign
nation.
It is a member of the United Nations, and it deserves full and equal standing at the United Nations.
Absolutely.
Let's return, if we can, Michael, because you pointed to the clock, so I know we're getting near the end of this segment. I want to return just for a tad to the Hague Odyssey, with your permission.
Okay, yeah, please.
And to the book, which is available, since you asked me to comment on this.
Yes.
It's available on Amazon. It's available on Amazon for Kindle. And it's available through the HagueOdyssey.com. This book starts and ends with a commitment to help people understand the battle Israel has on the front lines of terrorism, and her struggle for justice at the United Nations. And those two words, battle and struggle, are interchangeable. They could be in the first sentence or in the second sentence. Because it all evolves around a basic principle. And the principle is this. Every nation state in the world has the right and obligation to defend her people.
Right.
That's axiomatic. And I'm going to repeat it, but now insert. Every nation state in the world, including Israel, has the right and obligation to defend her people. And every freedom-loving person, every person who believes in democracy and the rule of law, every person who believes in responsible government, who applauds the vibrant democracy that exists here in Israel, needs to understand that terrorism prevention security fence has done one thing that it was designed to do, and that is save lives. Lives on both sides of
Absolutely.
The fence.
Absolutely.
Lives of people of all religions, lives of visitors as well as residents. And lastly, you know, Israel's High Court of Justice has received and reviewed petitions by both Israelis and Palestinians calling for the relocation of the terrorism prevention security fence, mm-hmm. calling for the wall to be modified. And the court has ordered the Israeli government and ordered the Israeli Defense Forces in a number of cases to relocate the line of the fence the line of those portions that include the wall. It's ongoing now. There have been numerous decisions, and in a vibrant democracy, one has to applaud the democratic work of a high court that takes the issue of terrorism so seriously. To conclude, however, it is unconscionable that the International Court of Justice, in reviewing the issue referred to it by the UN General Assembly, asking for the advisory opinion, didn't only fail, but refused to give deference to the Israeli High Court of Justice's jurisdiction over the issues presented to the Israeli court. I can't imagine the International Court of Justice failing and refusing to honor the dignity or give deference to the highest court of